The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Well, good morning, everyone. What a treat to be here with my friend Enkyo. We were having a wonderful time together, being playful in Japan just a few months ago. And I talked to Joan this morning, and she sends her love to you. Yeah. Don't wait. Waiting is full of expectation. Waiting for the next moment to arrive, we miss this one. Don't wait. Dying folks taught me that. I was washing the back one time of one of our patients, a guy by the name of Joe, and as I was washing his back, he leaned over his shoulder to me and he said, "I never thought it would be like this." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Dying." And I said, "What did you think it would be like?" And he said, "I never thought about it." And in that moment, that realization, the fact that he'd never reflected on his mortality, was actually a cause of greater suffering for him than his terminal lung cancer. Yeah. Don't wait. That's the elephant in the room, right? It's the thing we all know, it's the truth we all know, but we avoid talking about it, right? We use euphemisms, joke about it, we project our worst fears onto it, try and avoid the conversation completely if possible. Well, we can run, but we cannot hide. You know? There's an old Sumerian myth, I think a lot of you maybe know it, of a merchant who sends his servant to the market to buy the household goods. And while the servant is shopping in the market, he bumps into someone, he turns around, and he sees that it's death. And he looks at death, he's really terrified, you know. And death looks back at him, and then he runs. And he runs back home to the merchant, and says to the merchant, "I was in the market, and I bumped into someone, and I turned around, and she was death. And she gave me this threatening glance. So I need to get out of here. Lend me your horse, and I can get out of town." You know, we all are doing that, right? "Lend me your horse so I can get out of town." Yeah. She said, "I will ride to Samara, and there death will not find me." Famous line. And of course, the merchant goes back to the market. The guy rides away in a fury, and then the merchant goes back to the market and runs into death himself. And he says, "Hey, why'd you do that, scaring my servant like that? That was a terrible thing, threatening him like that." And death, of course, says, "Well, that was not a threatening gesture. That was a look of surprise. I was surprised to see him here in Baghdad when I knew tonight I had an appointment with him in Samara." We can run, but we cannot hide. I mean, to imagine that at the time of our death, we will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime is an absurd gamble. Yeah? Don't wait. I think the encounter with death, at least in my experience anyway, I'm sure in yours as well, is that it opens us in a way to the deepest dimensions of our humanity. And when we only talk about dying as making the best of a bad situation, which is the way we normally talk about it in this culture, "Well, how's he doing?" "Oh, he's making the best of a bad situation," right? I think what happens is we devalue dying, and I think we rob it of its holy significance. So, absent of a more meaningful conversation, I think a lot of people are dying in fear and distress. And I think we can do something about that. So I always, in a talk like this, say, I want to invite death into the room, you know. I want to sit down with it. That's a big part of our practice anyway, isn't it? Sit down with death. Have a cup of tea with her. Get to know her really well, you know. See what she can teach us about living this life. For me, death is a secret teacher, you know, hiding in plain sight. You know, and she shows us really what matters most. And the really good news is that you don't have to wait until the time of your dying to learn the lessons she has to teach. And I've been at this for some time now. We started Zen Hospice more than 30 years ago. And you know, we didn't have much of a plan when we started it. We just thought there was a natural match between people like ourselves who are cultivating the listening mind, listening heart, and people who needed to be heard, folks who were dying. And we didn't have more of a plan than that, honestly. And the rest we made up. We worked with folks mostly who lived on the streets in the beginning, alcoholics and prostitutes, and people living on the margins of society that didn't trust very easily, you know. So if we were going to be of any use to them, we had to be real. We had to be honest. We couldn't come at them with any Buddhist rhetoric, you know. Some people made these incredible openings and they found kindness and acceptance and love and extended forgiveness and all these beautiful things. But a lot of them, they turned to the wall and withdrawal and depression and hopelessness, and they never came back again, you know. All of them were my teachers, yeah. A lot of folks that I worked with, they came from cultures that I didn't know. Oftentimes speaking languages that I couldn't understand. There was a man, a Nguyen, I remember he was Vietnamese, and he was really scared of ghosts. Really terrified of ghosts. Every night was a big thing for him to go to sleep. And his roommate, Isaiah, who was an African-American man, he was very comforted by nightly visits from his dead mother. Yeah. There these two were in the room together, yeah. And you know, I worked at the very beginning of the AIDS epidemic, you know. We saw a lot of people, you know, in their 20s who were just starting their lives, you know. And there was this woman, Elizabeth, I worked with at 93. I remember she said to me, "Why has death come for me so soon, Frank?" Yeah. There was a man I worked with, he was a hemophiliac. And he contracted the HIV virus from a blood transfusion. But the really devastating part about this is that the year before, he disowned his son. When his son called him up to tell him he was gay and that he was living with the HIV virus. And now I remember being with both of them in Bernal Heights, you know, in this little house. There they were in twin beds in the same room, being cared for by Agnes, the son's mother, and the father's wife, you know. Don't wait. I've seen ordinary people, people like you and I, you know, regular folks, sometimes develop incredible capacity to meet what they thought was unbearable or unimaginable, their own dying, but to meet it in remarkable ways. Sometimes that happened in the final months of life, days of life, minutes of life. And we might say, too late, and I would agree, it's too late in the final minutes of life. But here's the thing, if that possibility exists then, well, it exists now, right? And again, we don't have to wait into the time of our dying to step into that transformation. Wow. The folks that were able to do that, I think that really what helped them is some willingness to explore the deeper dimensions of what it means to be human. I think what becomes clear when we're sitting at the bedside is that fragility and impermanence is woven into the very fabric of our lives, right? And it's possible to hold it all with love and compassion That's what I saw time and again. You know, impermanence is not the cause of our suffering. We rely on impermanence, actually. It gives us perspective. Embracing the truth that all things will end, will come and go. I think it encourages us not to wait until some other time to start living our lives. A lot of us have this idea of later, like death will happen later. Does anybody have that idea? Yeah, you have it, yeah? Death will happen later, yeah? Yeah, no sense worrying about it today, huh? Now, later gives us that comfortable buffer, you know, that comfortable distance from the experience. But, you know, impermanence, change is not later. It's now. Right here, right now. It's the fundamental truth of our experience, eh? I mean, where's this morning's breakfast? I ate mine in a really big hurry. Where is last night's lovemaking? Yeah. Someone please tell me where my blonde hair has gone. I mean, we know this, right? We know our mother's treasured vase is going to one day fall off the shelf and smash. It's going to do it, you know. That our car is going to break down, you know. That people we love are going to die. We know that, you know. The challenge, of course, is to move that understanding from our heads and nestle it deep in our hearts. It's funny, we all agree that things come and go, right? Seasons come and go. Trends peak, relationships come and go, right? This is our experience. Everything's changing except me, right? I'm the one solid thing moving through a changing world, right? This is it. I mean, that's how we think about it sometimes. I see friends I haven't seen for years. I just ran into somebody just yesterday that I haven't seen in 40 years. And she came up to me, she said, "Oh, it's so great to see you, I haven't changed a bit." And I was like, are you kidding? I mean, I was kind of offended by that, actually, that I hadn't changed a bit. Of course I've changed. Everything is changing except me. Death isn't a stranger. It's always presenting itself. It's always showing itself to us, right? All the time. This moment you're living now, it will never come again. And you don't know how many more moments you're going to have. And no matter how much you accomplish or how many times you do something, there's going to come a time when you do it for the last time. I was teaching a retreat for docs and nurses on compassion, and I had a heart attack in the middle of the retreat. Actually, I didn't have a heart attack. I had heart pain. And like a lot of people with heart conditions, I completely denied it. I mean, the first time I had this pain rushing through my body, and I thought it was indigestion. And so I got my assistant to give me some Tums, and that was it. Second time the pain came later in the day, I was leading a meditation on sensing the body. It was just rippling through, sensing, you know. That's how it was. Completely denied it. The third time, I was in a video conference with Ram Dass. And I love Ram Dass, he's a dear friend, and I really love him, you know. But I found myself getting emotionally irritable with him. And I was saying under my breath, "Ram Dass, shut up, you're talking too much, you know." And it reminded me of my son's mother when she was giving birth, you know. She got really irritable with me when I was giving her suggestions, yeah. So it was that emotional irritability that actually got my attention. And I said, "Ram Dass, I have to go now." And they took me to the hospital and I had a heart attack in the ER, yeah. I used to think I knew a lot about dying until I had a heart attack. Then I realized I didn't know much at all, and that's a good thing. There was a very famous Tibetan teacher who he himself had heart troubles, and he called me up when I was recovering to sort of, you know, wish me well. And I thought, oh, good, he's going to know, you know. He's going to give me some practice that will really help me through. Because, you know, when I felt depressed and helpless and weak. And so he called up and I said, oh, great, so glad to talk to you. How'd you deal with all this, the beauty, the horror, the depression, you know? Long pause on the other end of the phone. And then very typical Tibetan, he said, well, I think it's good to have a heart. And he said, and if you have a heart, you should expect it will have problems. And then he told me to rest, and he hung up. That was it. No esoteric practice, you know. And I thought afterwards, you know, he's really right, you know. If you have a heart, if you have a human body, you should expect that we'll have problems. I mean, who told us otherwise? Where did we get the idea that it would be otherwise? There's this phenomenon that I've encountered a lot in working with people, particularly women with cancer. And it's something they talk to each other about often, but not so much outside their circle. And a friend of mine coined it as a secret gratitude. Secret gratitude. And it means that once they've gotten over the initial shock of their diagnosis and they've lived into the illness a little bit, they begin to feel this perspective and this feeling like they can say no to stuff. They don't have to go to really boring dinner parties anymore, you know. And they can say yes to the things that they really love, you know. It's a kind of secret gratitude. They say, you know, I can finally rest. Yeah. I remember in my own case, my own condition, that when I came home, it took me a long time to recover. They had cut the phrenic nerve in my, and so my diaphragm didn't work, so it meant my lung wasn't inflating, so it took several months to heal. Actually, here's a sidebar. It took several months to heal, and then I went back to the same retreat center where I'd had this heart attack, and I did a little personal retreat for myself. And I'm sitting, you know, and after a day of bike riding, and I'm sitting, okay, good. And then I begin to feel all this heart pain. And I think, ah. Oh. I call my friend who's a therapist, and I said, don't you think this is probably just my mind, right? I'm just back in the psychosomatic. I'm back in the same place. Got to be that, you know? She said, yeah, it could be, but it could also be your heart, stupid. Go to the hospital, you know? And I went to the hospital, and we had another heart attack. And the grafts had failed, that they had, they had done a triple bypass, and the grafts had failed. I was supposed to go to Italy to teach. Jack Kornfield called me up and he said, Frank, he said, you got to rest. He said, you just got to take care of yourself. And I said, Jack, I do take care of myself. The only time I have heart attacks is when I'm at meditation retreats, you know, at Catholic retreat centers, you know. And he said, well, don't go to Rome, it'll kill you, you know. Yeah, these women say, now I can finally rest. There was a woman in our hospice, her name was Adele. She used to live in New York, actually. She was this rough, tough Russian Jewish lady, 86 years old, just character. And the night she was dying, they called me up, and I would go in and be with people, oftentimes when they were dying. And I went in the room, and there she was with her feet sort of dangling off the bed in her dressing gown. I went and sat in the corner, because that's my way. Sit in the corner, you know. Look and see, is anything really needed before you jump in to help? Yeah. And sitting there in the corner, I watched carefully, and I saw her breath, and I saw that there was a lot of struggle in the breath, this despite the fact that we made all the right interventions. There was morphine on board and oxygen and all these things. And there was this really wonderful home health aide sitting next to her. And in a very well-meaning way, she turned to Adele and she said, you know, Adele, you don't have to be scared. You don't have to be frightened. We're right here with you. And Adele looked at her and she said, honey, if this was happening to you, you'd be frightened. So I stayed in the corner, yeah. And then a little while later, this very well-meaning attendant said to her, you know, you look a little cold, would you like a shawl or a blanket around your shoulders? And Adele shot back, of course I'm cold, I'm almost dead. I thought, wow, you know, I hope I have half the tenacity of this woman when I'm dying. But I watched carefully, and maybe you could sense in the story too. I saw a couple of things there. One was that there was a struggle. There's a labor to dying, just like there's a labor to getting born, you know. In her case, it was manifesting in the breath. And the second was that she didn't want to talk about philosophy. She didn't want to talk about tunnels of light or bardos or anything. She just wanted real human contact, honest relationship. So I pulled my chair up really close to her. I knew her for a few months, so I could be quite honest with her. And I said, Adele, would you like the struggle a little less? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, I noticed something there. Just there, at the end of the exhale, you know, just before the next inhale, there's this little gap. You know, I wonder if you could put your attention there just for a minute. I'll do it with you. Now, this is a Russian Jewish lady, 86 years old, tough as nails. She doesn't care beans about Buddhism or meditation or any of these things. But she's highly motivated in this moment to be free of suffering. Yeah? That's what got most of us to sit on our cushions, if we're honest, right? So I said, you know, let's see what happens if we just put our attention there. Now, that's an extraordinary moment. We all know it from our Zazen practice, you know? It's a moment of fear or faith, right there, that gap. I mean, do you actually trust the next breath is going to come? Or do you have faith in that? Or do you start micromanaging it in some way, you know? I mean, the breath has been doing fine all day long, right, until we go to sit meditation, and then we think we should have a deeper breath or something like that. So anyway, she did it. If she would breathe in, I would breathe in. If she would breathe out, I would breathe out. That simple. No words, no guidance. But I noticed that as we did this for some time, this fear that was characterizing her face just kind of drained away, actually. And at some juncture, she said to me, I'm going to rest now. I'm tired. I said, okay. And she laid back on her pillows, and sometime later she died very peacefully. I think she found a place of rest in the middle of things. Yeah. I mean, none of the conditions had changed. She was still dying. There was still, you know, trouble with the breath. But right in the middle of that, she found a place of resting. Yeah. That place that's always available to us. She found it in the breath, but where do you find it, you know? And my God, you know, do we have to die before we can rest in peace? When I was sick, people were so kind, you know. Boy, people are really kind. My name was on altars, maybe here, in a lot of places, you know, people wishing me well. And people would email me or send notes, and my wife would read them to me, and I could take in one or two, and that was all I could handle, you know. I couldn't receive all of this. But one of the most beautiful things about that, the love coming from outside, was that it woke up, in a way, this love of my own being for me. And it was something I was familiar with, but I became much more intimate with. And as that love sort of established itself, I felt this trust, deep trust, like confidence, trust in reality, you know, like a basic trust, like you trust when you close your eyes and they'll open again, you know, or the sun will come up in the morning. Basic trust. And with this trust, I found rest, deep rest, like I'd never known before, actually. I mean, body at rest, heart at rest, consciousness at rest, really at rest. Impermanence is humbling, isn't it? I mean, it's absolutely certain yet completely unpredictable. And the mind hates uncertainty. You know, just rebels against it, you know. It makes us feel vulnerable. And we scream, do something. make something happen. And we don't know what to do often, so we worry. That's usually our best strategy that we can come up with. We worry. Worry is the ego's way of satisfying ourselves with an answer. You know? So we strategize and project all our hopes and fears into the future. You know. It just saddens me to realize the amount of worry that people are carrying around every day. That we walk around with that, you know? Worry gives small things a big shadow. Every time we come into this zendo, or most zendos in the world, you know, on the Han is written that beautiful teaching, and it's translated in lots of different ways, you know. Let me respectfully remind you to be aware of the great matter, life and death. You've chanted it so many times, right? Do not squander this life. Usually we think that means we should do something. Don't waste this life. We should do something really valuable, you know? And it throws us into a kind of activity sometimes. And that's a good thing to do, but it sort of contradicts this other very fundamental idea in Buddhism that we shouldn't be so fixed on goals and accomplishments. Yeah? So how do we do that? How do we have a movement toward goals? And it's good to have goals. It's good to have accomplishments. Yeah. But the way we push toward it, that's the challenge to look at. You know, the habit that gets set up around trying to make something happen. So then even when it does happen, the habit to keep making something happen remains. Don't wait. Suzuki Roshi used to talk about, he said he didn't like the word patience so much. He said, patience is just waiting calmly. You know, it still has the idea that something's coming, you know. He liked the word constancy. I like that, you know, constancy. That's what we do in our Zazen practice, right? Continuous contact with our experience. So for me, a subtler understanding of don't wait is non-waiting. Yeah, just non-waiting. Bernie died. Oh, I'm just heartbroken. And you know, it's like we know it, right? We know this is going to happen. We knew it was going to happen with him. And yet the mind is still shocked and the heart is still sad, you know? Joan Halifax Roshi wrote in a thing today. She said, "I'm a Buddhist and I'm grieving." Well, I thought it was so honest, you know? But one of the things that I always loved about Bernie was that he, you know, his whole teaching was about be who you are, you know? Be exactly where you are. Don't try to be anything other than you are. Clear mind comes, be with that. If a confused mind comes, be with that. And that extraordinary teaching, which he must have said 10,000 times, you know, about wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and laugh at yourself, you know? Don't wait. You know, for me, this life isn't about getting born and getting a good education and finding the right partner and getting a nice house on a pretty street so you can go to sleep and wake up in the morning and do it all over again. I don't think that's what this life is about. I think it's to embrace everything. Yeah. To know that some of us will make love while others make war, you know, to get it that there are babies like my granddaughter who was born into the loving arms of a mother who kisses her bright future into her cheeks every day. And there are babies like my friend Carolyn whose mother left her in a dumpster when she was born. Yeah. There are kids being shot in our schools. and other teenagers that are speaking truth to power. You know? There are babies crying, wailing tonight in Syrian refugee camps. And there are other kids who are making tents in living rooms, you know, out of couch pillows and bed sheets. There is hopelessness and despair, and there is the passionate, holy commitment, really, to make a better life for all of us. Yeah. And there's me talking, right, and you're listening, and the apparent separation that's here. And then there's this unity, the moment we remember that there's love. Yeah. When I was sick with my heart attacks, I studied famous people who'd had heart attacks. And to see if they could maybe have some wisdom. And one of the people I studied was Abe Maslow. And Maslow had a heart attack and almost died. And then he said something, I'm paraphrasing, but basically he said, death and its present, its ever-present being makes love, passionate love, possible. Yeah. I've been around folks who are dying for a long time. And the questions that they often ask at the end of life, they're not really about the five great regrets. I mean, you know, or what happens after we die. They're usually about something like, am I loved? And did I love well? And if those are the really important questions at the end of our life, well, aren't they really important now? Don't wait. Dying folks taught me that. Thank you.